In 1975, Jaws was released. It is routinely regarded as one of the greatest films of all time and is generally credited with creating the concept of the summer blockbuster. In 1978, in an obvious cash grab, Jaws 2 was released, failing to have lightning strike a second time, but presenting a generally enjoyable film. In 1983, Jaws 3D was released, shamelessly attempting to take advantage of a gullible audience. By 1987, there was no pretense of quality as Lorraine Gary and Michael Caine cashed paychecks for sleepwalking through a pointless and incredulous sequel. In 2016, Paul Spitero created Is It Jaws, in which he and a group of rotating guest hosts discuss new and old movies and place them up against the Jaws scale, which ignores some elements of the actual films and sets forth a rating scale. Jaws, an all-time great classic film. Jaws 2, an enjoyable film with some flaws but worthy of multiple viewings. Jaws 3, a moderately enjoyable film. And finally, Jaws 4, a bad movie. Please join Paul and his guests as they ask the ever-important question, is it Jaws?
Your file shows no kills, Bond. But to become a 00, it takes two.
How did you die?
Your contact? Not well.
You needn't worry.
The second is...
Yes. Considerably.
The man was Le Chiffre, private banker to the world's terrorists, which would explain how he could set up a high-stakes poker game at Casino Royale in Montenegro. If he loses this game, he'll have nowhere to run. You're the best player in the service.
The Treasury has agreed to stake you in the game. But if you lose, our government will have directly financed terrorism. I will be keeping my eye on our government's money and off your perfectly formed house.
You noticed.
I hope our little game isn't causing you to perspire.
It doesn't bother you, killing those people.
Well, I wouldn't be very good at my job if it did.
How's our girl? Melted your cold heart yet?
James, get the girl out.
You're not going to let me in there. You've got your armor back on.
I have no armor left. You've stripped it from me. Whatever is left of me. Whatever I am. I'm yours.
The only question remains. Will you yield? In time.
Hello, everybody, and welcome to Is It Jaws? I'm Paul Spitero, and I am here with what has become our regular James Bond crew. And I'm going to introduce them going clockwise around my screen. So at 2 o'clock, it is Mr. Chris Tyler.
You want me to be half monk, half hitman?
At 4 o'clock, we have Mr. David Pascarella.
Not like we need the money.
At 6 o'clock, Mr. Scott H. Gardner.
What? Oh, hi.
At 8 o'clock, Mr. Brian Hughes.
My brother from Langley. Not really, but okay.
9 o'clock, Mr. Sean Whalen.
Pleasure to be here, sir.
And at midnight, Mr. J.C. Vaughn.
The name's Vaughn.
J.C. Vaughn.
Yeah.
I knew somebody. Come on,
that was like T-ball, guys.
That was. So I was going to go with You Know My Name, but, you know.
Oh, we'll get to that. So today we're taking a look at Casino Royale, and I'm really, really interested, and I'm kind of stoked to hear what everybody's going to think about this one, because this is clearly the producers saying, we're wiping the slate clean, we're starting all new, we're going to be influenced, and the Bond franchise has always been influenced by the latest trends. We're going to be influenced by movies such as the Bourne movies, and we're going to actually create a continuity. I will start off by saying I saw this on the first day with people I worked with, and I did see it a second time in the theater, and I've seen it a couple of times since. And just to give my thumbnail on it, I have made the distinction often between what I think is the best and what I think is my favorite. For this point, up until from Dr. No to Casino Royale, I think this might be the actually be the best film in the series. Although Goldfinger is my favorite, no question. So we'll get into the discussion, and I'm curious to see how you guys feel. But again, going clockwise, Chris, you're up.
Oh boy! The bad taste I had in my mouth from the final two Brosnan outings led me to not see this in the theater and to wait until it hit DVD, wherein I was very pleasantly surprised. And I think I think that might have been the case for a lot of people like me. I think maybe a lot of people avoided that. Like, I want to hear the reviews on this. I want to listen to some people that I trust before I go diving back into this franchise. And I think it's a reasonable concern to have. You can recast and say we're taking it in a new direction, but until stuff is actually on celluloid and people have seen it, there's really no way to know, because you can make a trailer look like anything. So in terms of it being probably the best made film, it would be kind of hard to argue that. It's in my favorites. I don't know if it is my favorite, so I'll just say that.
Okay, Dave, you're next.
Well, the last one left such a bad taste in my mouth that I waited 19 years to see this picture.
You are our Casino Royale virgin.
I was a holdout all this time. But yes, I finally watched it last night, and I enjoyed it. I thought it was fantastic. Talk about an upswing. Wow. It was really good. I had a lot of fun with it. I don't want to go, I guess we're not going to go into details yet, but thumbnail sketch, it was great despite the absence of J.W. Pepper. I thought he'd be recast and brought in the Miami-Dade Police Department. I was a little disappointed in that.
Okay, Scott.
Sadly, I can't remember when I first saw this picture, but just to give my history as I remember it on this, as I've said for the last several episodes now, despite considering myself a James Bond fan, I bowed out when Brosnan came in, just because I've long hated that guy as an actor. So he was just box office poison for me. So I just bowed out, and I didn't watch any of those films, you know, when they released or anything. And then when Daniel Craig got cast, I don't know, maybe you guys will remember this, but, you know, shitstorms on the internet are nothing new. And that was a big one. I can remember everybody being up in arms about, blonde James Bond, and he's way too short, and he's way too this, and he's way too that, and blah, 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 and all this stuff. And so I just adopted a total, like, you know, all the Brosnan ones kind of look like they sucked, you know, from afar, just judging them, you know, book by its cover type of thing. So I'm like, I'm just going to wait and see what everybody says. So I'm pretty sure I ended up seeing it probably on like HBO or something. And I don't even think like I intended to watch it. I think it was one of those like flipping channels and just happened to catch it as it was starting type of thing. Cause my first memory, as I recall it, is the chase at the beginning, the, you know, with the mongoose and the cobra in the pit, which is pretty, you know, pretty much at the beginning of the movie. And just being floored, like, holy shit, this was a really, really good movie and really enjoying it a lot. But the other thing that has made a lasting impression on me from this movie is, you know, just two words, Eva Green. I absolutely fell in love with that woman. In this movie, and have gone out of my way to watch, you know, other movies that she's in. Whether
can't imagine
were,
why.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah, and you know, some movies that, you know, otherwise I would have absolutely no interest in ever sitting through just because she's in it. So, yeah, but yeah, really impressed with this one, and looking forward to talking about it.
Brian, what do you say?
Oh, I saw it in the theater. Though I had to go and see it again. I really liked what I saw, but I had a very pregnant wife sitting next to me, and she didn't care for Daniel Craig as Bond. From the moment that he sprang up out of the water, she's like, no, I'm out. And she wasn't feeling good. So I'm sitting there, like, she gets up and leaves, and I'm sitting there going, wait, but I'm watching this, and I'm enjoying this. And she would come back every few minutes, and she goes, are you enjoying this? And I'm like, yeah, a lot. So she would, like, go out and play video games or whatever and, you know, come back. And so I had to go see it again and, you know, just by myself so I could just focus on it. But I really enjoyed it. I you know, then I said it was the best Bond movie in the modern era, and I consider the modern era starting with Pierce Brosnan. And I still, you know, the thing is, I still got my favorites from the previous era, you know, For Your Eyes Only still is my favorite Bond film altogether. But this one was so well put together, so well done. You know, I just, and it only goes downhill from there.
Sean,
hey, I got a quick question for Brian.
Yeah.
Were the Star Wars prequels filmed in that room that you're sitting in?
I was forced to paint the walls green because Kurt Greenfield might have to do a weather report when he was visiting. I'm kidding. No, the previous owners of this house were Notre Dame fans.
That's the wrong color green, though.
I know. It's also wrong out on the curb where they had the address numbers put in. But it was the teenager wanted to go to Notre Dame. It was their goal. They got the walls painted. I'm stuck with it.
Okay. Sean, what do you say?
So this was one I saw in the theater. Actually, similar to some of Scott's comments, I was worried for this one, just mainly because there was a lot going on at the time about the casting and whether or not this was going to be a good Bond. And I, you know, I knew that the Brosnan ones were showing a serious decline as well. So similar to another franchise I like Doctor Who, and where they change the actor, and when the actor changes, it'll change a lot of times the tone and supporting cast and things like that with it. I was looking forward to a change with Bond, hoping that it was going to be good. I saw this and was blown away. I mean, it was, especially with how worried I was in there. My worry walking out was, do people going to go see it? You know, start looking at box office numbers and hoping that this movie was actually seen because of the fact that they were getting back to the roots of the franchise. In between the Brosnan film, last Brosnan film and this, I'd been reading a lot of the John Gardner books and things like that, just trying to fill the Bond itch. So it was, I was pleasantly surprised how much this Bond kind of tied more to what novelizations were doing with him. And Daniel Craig really exceeded what a lot of the criticisms were of him, that he was going to somehow be soft or wasn't somehow going to be that. It was the farthest thing from that, that's for sure. And what he did with his portrayal. This is a good movie.
Jeff, you're up.
I've got to say that converts make the biggest zealots. I bought into all the internet stuff, James Blonde, and all that. And when I went to see this, the beautiful grit of the pre-credits black and white sequence, followed by the opening titles being a direct throwback to the British dust jacket of the original hardcover, which was wasted on a lot of American audiences, but that's what it was. Then you get to the fast running scenes with all that phenomenal action like we'd never seen in a Bond film. I don't think there, I'm sure that, you know, as we take this apart, I'm sure we can find some misstep or another, but this is not only my favorite Bond movie, it is the best of the Bond movies. And I, and like you guys, I can separate what I think is best from what I think is really my favorite. Like, I like my second favorite, Spy Who Loved Me. And I've got my, you know, and we all have personal reasons for that kind of stuff. But this one blew me away. I saw it at home in Baltimore, where I was living at the time. Came to New York, saw it with my girlfriend, now my wife, and her brother. And went to Texas and saw it with my friends down there. Inside of a week, I saw it three times. And I had been so down on the franchise with the last two Brosnan. And unlike Scott, I don't have anything against Pierce Brosnan. I actually would have liked to have seen him get a script of this caliber.
Yeah.
I was blown away by this film, and I think I still remain so. There's something I like about every segment of this movie, and you guys have been here as I've described some of the other films, which leave people wondering if I even like movies. So I guess I'm sort of the opposite end of the spectrum on this one.
You know, there's can I follow up with something that he's just saying here? Because it just really struck me when he was talking about that whole opening running sequence. And, you know, we got the guy with the parkour skills that which was so popular at the time. So it was, you know, clearly a trope at the time. What I loved about that, when you mentioned grit, Bond was not that. Very fit, very athletic, but it was incredibly rough. And I loved that choice. It was something that I think when we're talking about atmosphere and tone, he was keeping up with him because of his fitness levels, not because he was matching him move for move.
No, you're absolutely right.
That was
absolutely
an absolute brilliant choice for that.
I think the
sequence.
Most critical or the most obvious part of that was when he came like through a window and Bond went through the wall.
Yes.
You know, it just shows you the distinction between.
Paul, there's one other part of what Sean just said too, and that's when they're up on the crane and he does the jump and you feel the impact of the metal.
Oh God. Yeah. Yeah. Every time I watch it still, it's just like, oh God, his ribs have got to be toast, man.
Yeah. And that, and I love that Bond is pursuing him through dedication, through his, as you said, general fitness level.
He's working harder, not smarter.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
From the very first time I saw this movie, I remember thinking that if this were, say, Roger Moore Bond, he would also be doing the parkour stuff. And now, not actually Roger Moore. They'd, you know, use a stunt double or whatever. And so I was struck by much the same thing, that they were drawing this beautiful dichotomy between this guy that was the skilled parkour guy and then Bond, that's just, I think it's M that calls him a blunt instrument in this movie. Yeah. I'd love that description of Bond in this.
That's how he starts.
That is what he is. He's all that suave and all that stuff that became kind of a cliche over time with Bond is all scraped away, and he's just rough. And I love Scott,
later on when we see him on the train, you're into the polish thing, but now you get the idea that that's a pretense.
Yeah.
And he's not comfortable.
Yeah.
Not remotely.
I will say I did see a very obvious stunt double with a blonde wig that looked as bad as Joe Pesci's in JFK, just as the parkour guy was doing his jump off the building onto the suspended platform, whatever that was.
But here's the thing. Right. I'll take a crappy-looking stunt double over the main actor doing it in front of your room that you're in.
And that's not really a problem. I have watched this movie so many times. I mean, just that it's one of my comfort food movies.
Yes.
And that's the first time I'd ever noticed a stunt double in that area there. It's, you know, so I was like, oh, wow, I'd never caught that before. And I think you'd be hard pressed to find stunt doubles on him much, because he did so much. I mean, he actually broke his two front teeth in one of the segments they recorded, the fight on the stairs in the
monster. In the hotel?
Yeah.
I kept thinking his knees are never going to be the same after this.
There's just so many things. There's so many things about that opening. I don't know. I didn't time it. I really should have done that. But where you have the pre-credit sequence and the immediate post-credit sequence, there's just so much going on that you don't have a chance not to get sucked into this movie. In my 2 cents.
Yeah, it is an excellent opening scene, and I think the biggest thing about it is after so much criticism about all the CGI and all of that, this is all practical effects. Oh, yeah. And as I understand it, there's only one part of that entire thing where one of the stunt people was even wired. Everything was free fall because they were such experts at the actual stunts that they were pulling off.
They did say that the CG was used just for the wires and then also for the putting the right building in there in Venice.
Yeah.
In the midst
Which is,
of all that.
That's almost
what
negligible.
It should be used for.
Yeah. Yeah,
but we had our levels of disagreement on the prior movie, but after the criticism from the prior movie, you know, obviously the producers heard what was being said, and they decided they were going to make the change. I do think, you know, you guys mentioned about the box office, and as I understand it, I think the box office, this was one of those movies that started off by Bond standards relatively slowly. But as word of mouth got out, it picked up dramatically.
And it's far enough back. It's weird to say this about just such a short time ago, but it's far enough back that a movie lifespan could still build on word of mouth.
Yeah, it would stay for 12 weeks, not, you know, 4.
Yeah.
Yeah. Well, and part of it now is that not only does it only stay for 4, but, you know, after 10 or 12, you know you're going to be able to see it on your TV set, which is, you know, in most cases, a large screen. And if it's, you know, in a lot of cases, why should I bother going to the movies? But the changes, I think, you know, we need to kind of talk about all of the changes in this. And the first one, I think the one that jumps out most, is the choice of Daniel Craig as the star taking over the Bond role. And there's things about Daniel Craig's attitude towards playing Bond that we could discuss, but I think that's as we get into the later movies. I don't think it was really known at this point. The blonde thing I think is almost silly because he, you know, it's like a dirty blonde. It's not, you know, he doesn't have that bright yellow bleached blonde.
He's not like a surfer.
Hair.
He's not
yeah,
like,
he
a surfer,
like a surfer. The not, comparisons.
It was fair game in the world of the internet.
But you know, the best comparison I ever heard about him was that he looks similar to Steve McQueen, and there is a definite similarity in
his
facial appearance. Yeah. And I think, you know, that should be enough to have people say, well, playing a rugged action star and he looks like Steve McQueen, I'm good with that. The fact that he's only 5'10", who cares? Sylvester Stallone, I think, is 5'8". Tom Cruise, I think, is 5'8". These guys, you know...
If Tom Cruise is 5'8", then I'm 5'8".
That's up to the... Okay, so maybe Tom Cruise is 5'6". I'm not even sure. But whatever the case may be, it's up to the director to put them, you know, in a position where you don't see that they're shorter. And 5'10 isn't particularly short. It's probably average.
No, it's 2 inches above the average male height if you go take the whole bell curve of the
world. So you know a decent director can take care of that with no problem whatsoever, just with the, you know, the blocking and how they frame the pictures. So that's no big deal. One of my notes that I made when I was watching it for the sake of talking about it today was I was trying to figure out, because we said, you know, I wish Brosnan had a script like this, but I don't think Brosnan could have pulled off this particular script. He isn't the guy you would cast as Bond.
Not this script. That's why I was careful to say a script of this quality.
Yeah, okay. And I agree with you on that, because I think Brosnan was somewhat underserved by his script writers. But this particular script, I think, in my mind, there's 4 of the Bonds could do this. And, you know, obviously Craig could, but I think Connery could have pulled it off.
Yeah.
I think Lazenby could have pulled it
off. Dalton definitely could have pulled it off.
And I think Dalton could have pulled it off.
Yep.
And I think that's it. I don't think any. I don't think that Pierce Brosnan or Roger Moore could have pulled this off.
Here's a thought experiment.
I want to stipulate younger Connery.
Well, yeah.
Yes.
Yeah. Not Diamonds Are Forever Connery.
Never say never Connery.
I'm saying this. From Russia,
if they had
Love
given
Connery.
This script as the first Timothy Dalton, do you think that run would have been more sustained and with more?
Yes.
Oh yeah, absolutely.
Yeah.
But I think with Dalton and with Brosnan, both times they decided, okay, we're going to try and go a little bit more serious. You know, we're coming off Roger Moore. We're going to try and go a little bit more serious. We're going to try and have a little gravitas to this. And both of their first films did kind of have that. But I don't think that the producers dove into it feet first the way they did in this one.
They didn't buy it the way they did for this one.
Well, the thing is...
There's a lot of lip service to it.
The thing is, before they brought in Daniel Craig, they were actually talking to Brosnan about doing it. And then Bourne series came out, and all of a sudden they realized, we're going to have to redo James Bond altogether.
I don't think we're going to keep
the modern audience. And so that's why, you know, they did everything different and brought in Daniel Craig.
Yeah, I don't think they were talking to Brosnan about doing this script. I think they were talking to him about doing another Bond movie.
But they're talking about doing Casino Royale, but they didn't say it was that script.
This was Martin Campbell, right, on this one?
Yeah.
Yes.
So it wasn't his first foray. So it's.
If you look at Martin Campbell's filmography, he does have a somewhat up and down history.
Yes.
Like he did the
Mask of Zorro is amazing.
But the Legend of Zorro is kind of boring.
And Green Lantern was terrible because I think that was him too.
Yeah, Green Lantern was terrible. No Escape I thought was a confusing mess.
I like No Escape, but that's me.
Edge of Darkness I've never seen because it's Tom Cruise, but I've heard it's really good. Oh no, that's not. That's Mel Gibson. I never saw that.
Edge of Darkness.
My mistake.
That's the one that takes place in Boston. Movie. I still haven't even seen that one.
Edge of Darkness is with Mel Gibson. I never saw that.
Is it the video game one? Is that the one you're talking about?
No.
I was thinking of Edge of Tomorrow, which is
Edge of Tomorrow. Of yeah, that's what I was thinking of too.
But that's
a
different movie. I was wrong about that.
Okay.
So his filmography seems, like I said, to be kind of up and down.
Depends on the script, I guess.
But I mean, the directing in this movie, and I don't want to get too much into. I want to get save directing for later. But I think he did a masterful job on this. I'll leave it at that for now.
Yeah, see, I couldn't remember anything about the guy, so I looked him up and was looking at his filmography and was kind of stunned.
Journeyman, I think, would be the best.
Other movies that he had done, because I'm like, I've seen some of these other movies, and none of them have the quality, and you know the. You know, just the cinematography that this movie does. It was very surprising to me.
I would argue that GoldenEye and Mask of Zorro were equal directorial efforts.
Oh, yeah.
They may not be quite the same film as this one is, but I think direction-wise, I think they both live up to this one.
Yeah.
But we could talk a little bit more about that as we go along.
But talking about Craig, you know, the thing is, if you look at his filmography in just a few years before, it really seemed like he was auditioning. Munich, Layer Cake, even his bit on Lara Croft. It seemed like he was just like saying, look, guys, I can be Bond. And Layer Cake is what probably cemented it for him.
Brian makes an interesting point there. I can say I didn't see that coming, but in hindsight, I think there's some validity to that. I just know, like I said, I totally thought it was a horrible idea, the casting.
It shuts you up right away.
The first 20 minutes of this movie, if you don't like it, I don't think you like Bond movies.
I was right there with you. I didn't watch the movie for 19 years. And you know, my wife was on the fence about watching it because she had other things she wanted to do. And I started it by myself. And I watched that first, the pre-opening sequence in black and white and part of the credits. And I stopped it and I said, you need to come and watch this. I said, this is going to be really good. He says, which is it? It's Casino Royale. He's like, the one with Peter Sellers? I go, no, no.
How old's your wife?
The new one.
I always do that. I always do that when people are talking Bond movies and they start talking about Casino Royale. I'll start talking about David Niven and Woody Allen and right. Peter Sellers. And they're like, what?
Uh-huh.
Yeah, I mean, I did
There's another version, too, I think, from even earlier. From
oh, the TV.
It was a TV.
It's right. actually the first with Peter Lorre.
And it was
it's
Barry
in black and white,
something.
Isn't it?
I can't think of it.
Yeah, Barry Nelson. Yeah.
Barry Nelson.
As Jimmy Bond.
Jimmy Bond.
And yeah, an American.
And Peter Lorre as Le Chiffre.
Well, that's pretty good casting.
So back to Daniel Craig for a moment.
Yeah.
I'm sorry. But just to talk a little bit more about Daniel Craig, I thought his performance in this and the way he was scripted was just top notch. There are many, many points in this where they're showing you what he is and they're not telling you. It's not even in the dialogue. So many emotion things, so many points where he's closed in and, you know, he's just a blunt instrument until he's finally won over. And then he opens up, and then he gets his heart broken, and then he closes back up again. You know, the bitch is dead.
Listen, I think your analogy is right on. He's not entirely a blunt instrument because he already has a bit of the wit that we associate with Connery's Bond, where he's and she says, "How is your lamb?" And he says, "Skewered." And he sympathizes.
That is a very Connery-like line, actually. But I do think he is not, you know, I think they made an effort to show this is the development. This is what turns James Bond the man into James Bond the super suave Bond.
And before this movie, I was one of those people that was like, I don't need his origin. He's one of those characters I don't need. I don't need the Joker to have an origin. I don't need James Bond to have an origin. You can allude to things here and there and play with that. One of those characters, I don't need an origin. If you're going to do an origin, this pretty much nails it.
Yeah, this I would have been against if they said we're doing Bond Begins, and I would have had a problem with it. But again, like you,
Chris, I'm of the age where I watched James Bond Jr., which had nothing to do with the Broccoli Company at all. But it was Bond on TV, so I was going to watch it.
You know, it's funny because like that opening sequence when he's fighting that guy in the bathroom is so rough. It's so unrefined. It's so dirty. And they, you know, they got the film grain and everything going on with it. And it's just like, yeah, this isn't, you're thinking to yourself, this isn't 007.
And he kind of is, though, when he takes that second guy out. Yes, considerably. It's like, well, there it is.
But, you know, the thing is like all through the movie, you see points where he is and points where he isn't. It's not until the very end when he's standing there on the steps with the gun in hand and the phone in the other that he is 007 James Bond.
I think it's really funny. This just occurred to me now, and now it makes a lot more sense in my head why I loved it so much. The grit of the scene you were just talking about, Brian, is very reminiscent of Luc Besson's La Femme Nikita.
And
I hadn't thought about that until right now, and now I can't get that idea out of my head. That's really interesting.
So what should I say
about my own comment?
Yeah.
also, you could even go to Leon the Professional. There's a little bit in there too.
Yeah. Well, if we're going to talk about Besson, sure, why not?
Where
you know how you know he isn't Bond yet? He's driving a Ford, and not a Thunderbird. Like a Tempo or something like
At that point, did Ford still own Aston Martin?
I don't recall. They might have back then.
I think they did.
Because there was a lot of product placement by Ford.
A fair amount of that.
Well, you know, this movie actually had a lot more muted product placement since Die Another Day was basically every ad shoved in your face every 5 seconds. This one, it was so muted except for the Amiga watch, just to throw that out there. But, you know, beyond that, it was very...
I
tasteful.
I know this is going to be jumping ahead a bit, But if we're getting into the cars and the vehicles and stuff like that, since we're talking about the Ford, I love when he's in the car park and the guy just sort of arrogantly tosses him his keys.
Yes.
And he just as uses someone who, his car.
As someone who daily works with rich, entitled a-holes, I love that scene in the movie. It just makes me smile every time.
The guy could have been Gert Frobe's brother, you know.
As soon as he took the keys, I'm like, he's gonna do a Mahoney and Police Academy.
I didn't know he was just about to go there.
You guys were talking about the scene at the end where, you know, he finally comes out. He's holding the gun. He's says, you know, James Bond, and that's kind of where it solidifies him. As kind of the Bond that we know. I think one of the other things that really works in that scene is that it's the end of the movie, and that's the first time in the entire movie that you hear the James Bond theme.
The first time you hear that phrase, the first time you hear the theme, and it has all come together at that point like a fine thesis.
Exactly.
Yeah. And we don't have a gun barrel scene at the opener. He's not Bond yet, so he can't do that stuff yet. He's at the end is when he's Bond, and that's now you can do that stuff.
And so is that, do you think, the reason why they didn't show naked women frolicking around in the beginning during the credits?
I think they were going for kind of a retro feel. I think
that I also don't think that was going to be the intention going forward, and that's partially just because of the times. Look, I want the hot chicks with the huge racks during the credits too. Call me a chauvinist pig. That's part of the reason why I'm here. Like, I want to see a guy kill with impunity, do the stuff that I will never be able to do, and then just enjoy myself in a world of make believe for 2.5 hours. Like, and I don't think that's a problem. You know,
women with chauvinist pig over here.
Yeah, women have romance stuff like it. It's all just wish fulfillment. It's all just entertainment. You know?
I've got to say, to me, and I mentioned this earlier, because I read all the Fleming novels, I read all the Gardner novels. The Fleming novels I read about ninth grade.
Okay.
The Gardner novels I read as they were coming out. You go to License Renewed, and that one I found like really great. So I was grabbed by the books in a pretty strong way. Been seeing the movies since my parents took me to a double feature of Dr. No and Goldfinger at the drive-in when I was a toddler. And that, but all that said is when I saw the opening credits of this, and they were so different. It was such a deliberate action to separate them from the films that had come before. And by choosing the animation they chose, which is very, very clearly based on the British hardcover dust jacket from the first release of Casino Royale, I'm like, holy crap, they're serious.
Yeah.
And what they had just shown us with the grid of the black and white sequence, is then for me, because I got what was going on, and I don't think it's a speed bump for the people who didn't get it. I think it's an Easter egg for the people who did.
Yeah. Well, I mean, it still sets the tone. It's not about the women. It's about, here's this guy that, and even in the credit sequence, they show him getting kicked around and struggling too. So this is the story that we're on. This is going to be a journey to self-actualization, if we want to you don't expect that in a Bond movie, but if you're gonna start out, it's kind of what it is.
They were able to surprise me, and I say that because there were scenes such as when he gets arrested at the airport. I knew Felix Leiter was gonna show up. I says, he's gonna wind up in jail, and Felix Leiter is gonna have to get him out. And I was kind of surprised that Felix didn't show up at that point.
Yeah, I think they kept Felix really hidden for a while. You know, they gave you a surprise
Well, they surprised me when he put the terrorist zone bomb on his own belt loop, and I was just like, oh,
that was great.
Oh, yeah. Okay, I guess we're okay. All right.
And you know what? What you just said, there's one really, really great moment. Bond smiles.
Yes. Yeah. And I was like, ooh, okay. So he's not at the I'm dead inside level of killing people. It's like, kind of enjoyed getting that one over on him.
Gotta say about that scene, though, that is the one fueled up vehicle that doesn't blow up when something taps it. I mean, it got hit by cars, got hit by bullets.
Didn't you watch that and say to yourself, I hope they respond a lot quicker in real life? It seemed like it took a while for anyone to notice this fuel truck racing around, smashing into things.
One of the things that I thought was really great about Craig in this one was the range of emotion that he was able to show.
Oh, yeah.
And it was subtle. It was a good range, but it was subtle. It wasn't in your face.
But he also goes really dark at certain points. He gets very cold on a level that some of the names that were thrown out before that could do this script, I think, are all accurate because they're Bonds that did go cold, you know, at certain points in time, but not to this level. And
I think the coldest moment is what I mentioned earlier is when he just said the bitch is dead.
The bitch is dead.
The job is over and the bitch is dead, which is almost straight out of the novel.
I think actually I had heard it is straight out of the novel.
Yeah. I have
this one. He was pretty close.
I'm trusting on that.
I'm sorry to interrupt you, Sean.
No, you're good. The key to all that is the fact that he is able to go to that place. And we saw it multiple points through the film where there's a danger of making your lead character unlikable. And he was able to pull it back. And the script obviously deserves a lot of credit for that. But if you don't have an actor who can actually portray that and take you as a viewer emotionally back to that place, where you're able to still like this guy, you're able to still feel that there are things that you, like, you're rooting for him, even though at times you don't want to and you want to smack him upside the head. I love that, because there were moments
by the time he's showering with his tux on, like, if you're not invested in him as a person by that point, then there's no hope for you. And I know that's later on in the movie, but by that point, you've already seen him go through a lot of shit.
Right.
But that scene in particular is very key because it's wordless, but they're both showing total vulnerability.
There's Paul, you're dead on with that one. And I think that one of the things that's so critical about it is that it works so well as a performance. It is framed so well visually and artistically, the color choice of what they're wearing against the tile of the backdrop, the water, and everything else, the impact of that's just magnified.
And combine it with what went before it, which is what put them in that position too. And it's just it's very, very powerful.
Not just that, but what went along with filming that scene, because they wanted her to strip down to just her underwear, and Daniel Craig was the one that insisted, "No, this is as far as she would get to get in here," and they did it in one take.
Really?
Yeah.
That's killer.
Yeah.
You know, I don't know if I buy the whole "the bitch is dead."
That was him suppressing his emotion.
Right. But
because at that point, he has to become, now I got to be the James Bond, the rest of the family.
And you get the fact that in her own way, M calls him on that right then. Yeah. And that change, it doesn't reject the line. It just changes it and says, "I know you're covering up. Surely you've thought about this." And she basically says, "Of course," when Bond hadn't realized it yet.
Right.
Yeah. Oh, yeah. No, that's what I think makes it so powerful, is that, he deep down inside, his heart is broken.
Yeah.
And it's probably the only time, unless you go to, other movies and you go to when Teresa Bond got killed.
That's probably why I like this one so much, too.
That's the only other time that his heart has ever been broken in one of these movies.
Yeah.
It was different than the scene earlier on where he showed coldness with the girl, Demetrios' girlfriend, where he's, like, ordering food. and he's ordering it for one because he's like, he's beelining out.
She got killed. She was collateral damage as far as he was concerned.
Sorry. Go ahead, Scott.
I just have to slightly argue Paul's point that that's the only other time he got his heart broken. I would also argue that when Felix's brand new wife was murdered in License to Kill, Bond takes that shit very personally.
But that's not a romantic entanglement.
No, but
it was Priscilla Barnes, so you let him have it.
But no, I don't think it was the same level of heartbreak for him. I do think it hit him hard, and I do think he really cared. I'm not trying to say he didn't, but it wasn't the level of heartbreak of being betrayed by his lover.
No, but his heart is broken for them, not necessarily for himself, and he's doing what his friend is not able to do, and that's one of the things that really works for me with that movie. But like I said, it's a minor point, but I just wanted to point that one out because I think that gets overlooked a lot.
Hey, I love License to Kill too, man.
So let's talk about Eva Green.
Oh yeah,
she's gorgeous. She's gorgeous in this movie. There's a tremendous amount of chemistry between her and Daniel Craig. You feel everything that's going on between them. And what I like about it is they both seem resistant to actually giving each other their hearts, and then you just see it happening where they can't help it.
Yeah.
And I think again, it's in not only in the script, because it is in the script, but it's in the performances too. You know that you can accept that this is real. Yeah. And I just think that's something that is very, very rare in a Bond movie, because usually, even when there is some chemistry, there's not enough scripting or not enough scenes to see why they feel the way they do.
Yeah, and
this one, I think it develops.
We get to it several times really, really quickly, and the performances are great. I think, Paul, you touched on giving some credit to the director earlier, and I think that that's really essential here, because a bad director can still miss great actors working together and grab the wrong take and things like that.
Yeah.
This is across the board, great performances. She's got a desperation that we see later in the, when the house is collapsing in the elevator scene.
Her death scene is brutal.
Yeah.
She's utterly brutal.
She's got a desperation. Brian, the other guys won't get this, but she looked crazy enough in that scene that Kevin would have liked her.
Yeah, I agree. I agree with that. I will say, going back though, that the scene where he gives her the dress and she gives him the coat seemed a little forced. It was almost sitcom-y or rom-com-y. And then the scene on the train where they're getting acquainted with each other just ran a little too long. They didn't have to stretch out the whole poker thing. And then when she mentions bluffing and he says, "Oh, you've heard of it, have you?" It just, those little bits felt forced. The rest of it was brilliant, though.
I love the whole train sequence.
Yeah, I don't have a problem with it either, Brian.
Yeah, I can't say it felt forced to me at all.
I get sucked into that every time because it's just that. As much as I like a big, dumb action movie, you put two great actors opposite each other and put the camera on, let them talk.
I know, but it's like, okay, Kevin Smith likes to hear people read what he writes, and so he lets his things go on and on and on into conversations that you really don't expect to ever hear people have, except people like us. And again, this is coming from someone that's watched this movie a lot. And so the little things start to stick out for me, and those are the things that stuck out.
Nobody's saying you're wrong, Brian. We just...
Yeah.
Didn't wait, get the experience wait,
Paul,
that you did.
Paul, yes, I am.
Well, the other thing is, as terrible as this is going to sound, there are going to be some people that go into this movie that don't, and that might not have ever played or watched poker and have no idea about it. So it's also just a way to throw in, I gotta throw something in about that. Go for it, Scott.
Yeah, no, that's me. I don't know shit about poker.
So there you go.
I'm lost and all that.
I say stuff. You're proving my point.
Chris, I mean, those cards, the hands that they call, all that stuff could be complete nonsense, and I would never know the difference.
No, it's actually very accurate.
I mean, I think
in fact, to be honest with you,
I mean,
Yeah, to be honest with you, they do a little bit too much there of telling you what's going on. Oh, look, it's the tail.
Yeah, but you kind of have to do that. I wish they had explained Baccarat in the original one. Shit, I didn't know what the hell was going on.
No falabank.
I'll sit and look at Sylvia Trench's boots the whole time, but I get no idea what the hands are.
But in this state, they did, you know, they added exposition in there that probably wouldn't have happened in real life just because they were trying to make sure that people who don't play poker would understand what was happening.
And I totally would qualify as that. One of the things, since we're talking about Baccarat real quickly, you know, them going Nufalabank and all that stuff, I just always loved Paul McCartney's fake grandfather in Hard Day's Night going, bingo.
He's very clean.
But the thing that I like about the train sequence and the poker game and some of the other visuals are I'm reading a book right now called Jamaica on the Tracks of James Bond. I just was on vacation there that was in the gift shop. I had to buy it. And it's about Jamaica's ties to Bond. The same author has done a bunch of them about France and Italy and these kind of things. And I'm really enjoying the book so far. But one of the things that hit me was in the early Bond films, it was still rich people and business people who traveled everywhere by jet. It was not the venue of the common man. These films, in their own ways, were travelogues. There's a glamorous version of that in this. I look at that train and I want to take that train.
Yeah.
You know? And I think that that's something that they achieved in this that is almost an outdated concept, but it worked. Mm-hmm. My two cents.
It's better than Amtrak?
Everything's better than Amtrak.
Oh, I got an email about the new Acela today. I can't wait to take it.
That shot of them coming into Venice on the boat, I was watching it again just two nights ago. I was like, I really want to go there, you know, because it just looks absolutely gorgeous.
Bond movies are shot well, especially for the exteriors, but this one looks great.
I just wanted to point out the irony of, you know, as you were saying, kind of maybe over-explaining maybe the all the intricacies of the poker game. At the same time, while doing a film that lost me about 5 minutes in as to what the hell's going on in the overall film. I find that just extremely funny because this is yet another one of those James Bond films that quickly loses me as far as I'm not really sure what Bond's up to or what the point or what the plot of this movie is, but man, I'm enjoying it. I'm just here for the ride.
I'm going to disagree with you a little bit on that one because I thought this one was one of the better plotted Bond movies where there was actually a logical sequence to where he ended up going that you could understand when he would go to do, you know, the next step. Terrorist who was going to blow up the airplane, and then he didn't. So then he had to set up the poker game to kind of recoup the money for the people who were ready to kill him for it and did try to do so. You know, like there was a logical sequence to it as opposed to, you know, he's walking through the streets of Jamaica and in the next scene he's in France. You know, there wasn't that.
But Paul, I got to say that you're probably one of the 12 people in this country that back in 2006 knew what it meant to short stocks. Because
that's true, I did.
Everybody would know about 2 years later.
Yeah, it's like there's a lot of things in there that could confuse the people. The one thing I found funny was that they kept saying how great a poker player James Bond was, but whenever he actually won a hand, it was because he had the best cards. They never showed him actually outplaying anybody.
That is true. He never bluffed anybody. He never called
I think that's a fair observation. On the other hand, I think we could argue that they gave him a heart attack in the middle of it, so we didn't really get to see the whole
thing.
which was yet another excellent scene.
Oh yeah.
But that last hand, just the sheer impossibility of it. And I'd seen it in another movie just a short while before. I'd seen Croupier with Clive Owen, and he had actually dealt everybody the same card that they dealt in that last hand.
The
was one, just kind of really bizarre.
The thing that I did like about it, and I'm not this isn't me disagreeing with what's being said here, but it's something I do think that they did well, was the using the tells, just setting the stage that Bond, it's not so much about Bond's skills as far as being a poker player, but as far as being able to read the table and what is going on with the other people that he's playing with.
Yeah.
That part I thought was a cool piece of the whole thing, just showing that it was his strategy in playing the other players. And it was something that Felix actually was recognizing, because he's like, I'm not going to be able to... I really liked the interactions with him and Felix. I liked the different placement, because you're right. There was like a certain points in time where I'm like, well, this is where Felix would appear. I liked that he didn't appear in those places, and we see him at the table. And we got to see he was watching Bond and recognizing, I'm not going to be able to do this.
Yeah.
He is.
And so in both of their cases, it's about them reading people, reading the room, reading what's going on, not the particular poker skills.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Half of poker is reading the cards and half is reading the man. I mean,
and really at some point, I think the conversation went, you mean to say everybody has a tell? And he was like, yes, everybody has a tell. It's just a matter of figuring out what it is.
Yeah. And Felix's was the look on his face like someone took his lunch money. I mean, that's how he looked there. Not the one where he went broke, but the one where Bond went out.
When you take a look at something that was said earlier about previous Bond movies, how there was, you know, they were skirting the lines in the opening credits. We had the naming conventions and all those tropes that were very, very something you're very used to in Bond. This is the first one where they're trying a new direction with that. Very dangerous place to go, because when you think of James Bond, you think womanizer, you think of the fact that he's always with a sexy woman and there's always that type of piece. This one, they did a very good job of trying to navigate that without avoiding he's with two sexy women. Through character development, we're giving you that same feel of these are exceptional women. Eva Green's portrayal and getting to see the way that we get to know her as a character. And when she dresses up, she dresses up. I loved their choices. The scene where they made the choice not to have her disrobe in the shower was a brilliant thing to do. Didn't take anything away from how beautiful of a woman that she is. If anything, yes, I agree. I think we got to see her in a very emotionally stricken way, and I felt that moment with her. They did a very, very good job of keeping sex appeal in this while navigating the new norm at that particular point in time.
And Bond's attraction to her is, it's tipped off early. It tips off early on, where he refers to his usual type, and she says something, and he says married.
Yeah.
Like, yes. He is not a guy that commits. He is that blunt instrument that we've been talking about, that, you know, as M said. And then it goes from there to their banter. It's not unlike a rom-com.
Yes.
And yet it's hiding both of the flaws in both of their characters. I just find it so compelling, Sean. I'm really glad you mentioned that, because she's one of the most distinctive, and I'm not talking about her any physical attributes. As a character, she is one of the most distinctive Bond women, simply because she's not killed off early. She, you know, like some of the ones we remember are actually the ones that got killed off early. There's just so many fascinating dichotomies in this movie, and that's one of them to me.
They could have gotten that wrong, and that was really something where, you know, if you would have like taken that heart and taken some of that, you know, that sex appeal out of the film, and not found some way to address that and keep that a part of the story, I think you lose James Bond in that piece. And I felt like it was an important part of the atmosphere, important part of the feel of this spy movie. There's a romanticism to it that's got to be there. It helps when you're going to some of the darkest and coldest sequences in this film that you've got that balance that was in
there. There's also a really important thing, since you just said the phrase spy movie, that even a newly minted 00 would get, he's not going to worry about falling for somebody on his side, which is why the betrayal works.
Yeah.
He's not going to be so stupid as to fall for somebody who he knows is on the other side. And so his guard's down a little bit because they're adversarial to start with. And man, I don't want to be like there's no problems with this movie, but there's so many great things about it.
I wanted to touch on the adversarial thing. When does she actually turn? When does she actually fall for Bond? Because that's the only thing in an otherwise pretty damn perfect movie, in my opinion, that continues to bother me a little bit, is that her sudden turn to Bond seems very sudden, because she may be falling for him in a way that we don't necessarily detect on screen with all the casino stuff, but she's still pushing him away. She's still, you know, at least not outwardly, you know, falling for his charm and all that sort of thing. She's still keeping him at arm's length. But then we go through the sequence where they're both kidnapped and he's abused and all that. When he comes around at the villa recovering, suddenly she lays it on him. You're I'm yours and all that. And every time I watch this, I'm like, well, what changed?
But I think it's more than that. The way I saw it, I saw her slowly developing the fondness for him. And I think the scene when they're in the shower is a very key on that thing. But she doesn't ever want to admit it until finally that he's recovering. And then she's like, you know, she just can't help herself anymore. She has to.
I also think that there's one thing here. And this is a point I have gone back and forth on this movie. And it's what M says later about when Bond was being tortured, she made a deal to keep him alive.
Right. Yeah. If you didn't care, you wouldn't do that.
There's an argument to be made that they showed us so much in this movie that they could have shown us something like that rather than telling it to us.
Well, until M says that, you don't know why Mr. White killed Lashif and didn't kill the two of them.
Yes.
And then when that comes out, you're like, oh, okay, that's why he only killed Lashif and left. And again,
back to your earlier comment, Paul, I do feel like that was a plot point that made sense. And the chronology of this movie works.
But also you have that moment where he almost dies.
Yes.
In the car and she comes walking up. She sees what's happened. She saves his life.
Yep.
Yeah.
And it's in that moment, you can see the desperation in her. I mean, there's so many emotions going across her face. I mean, that performance right there was amazing.
And I think there's some symbolism there where she stops him from having the heart attack and wins his heart.
Yeah.
Aww.
Nice.
I think that's intentional. I'm not trying
she realizes how much that she cares for him when she thinks she's going to lose him.
How far ahead was all this plotted out with the subsequent movies? Because
I don't think they had a friggin' clue, because you could tell just from the way that the next couple go, it's like...
Okay, well, they could not get the... They still couldn't get the rights to Spectre from Kevin McClory. So they were going to use Quantum as the new model for Spectre. And so it took them a while. They realized they needed to make another movie, because wasn't it like 4 years between the two?
Well, I mean, you have this, then you have Quantum of Solace, then you have Skyfall, and then you have Spectre, which is when they... obviously had the rights to use Blofeld and
right.
the name Spectre.
And you know that they would not have had those rights if MGM hadn't been willing to sell off the rights to Spider-Man.
Yeah, I've heard that.
Yeah.
Well, the reason I ask is for what JC said. I'm trying to follow the train of logic here. And so to me, it only works when you have future knowledge later on with Quantum of Solace of exactly who Mr. White is and who he works for and all that you kind of need an explanation for why he didn't kill Bond. Because for me, I always assumed he wasn't there for Bond. When he comes into that thing and he shoots Lachif, he was there for Lachif.
Scott, I absolutely accept that. That he wasn't there for Bond.
That's what how I the thought, book is.
But that's yeah. what I thought until they said she made a deal. And then I thought, okay, now that even gives me more of a reason why he would spare Bond.
But why do you need an explanation? If you bought that, if that was your assumption that, well, he wasn't there to kill Bond, so that's why he didn't. So why give an explanation beyond?
Because it seems so easy to just kill Bond there and know that he won't be a threat to them.
Two things. One, that right there. And the other thing is this. I think that it shows that M still understands more of the game they're playing than Bond at that point in his James Bondiness.
Right. Okay, so now I want to shift the conversation over to M for a little bit, because we have Judi Dench playing M, which she played in previous movies, and yet same actress, same character, totally different.
Yeah.
She's nothing like she was in the previous movies.
I think there's elements of GoldenEye in it, but I agree.
And I think that is just the tone of the movie and her adjusting to the tone of the movie and the script for her adjusting and her being such a good actress that she can just turn on that. And I thought she was great in this movie. And I think she's been great in other ones, but it's just you see the character range that she's able to have, and I just
was
impressed with it.
With what they were doing here, they had to be very, very careful using anybody from the previous Bond movies. You know, as far as if you're really trying to set the stage that this was something different. To your point, they put her in this film, and she didn't. You're right, GoldenEye. I totally agree with you that, like, okay, you can echo it back to that. But I did not feel like because she was in it, because of the way that everything just played out in this one, that they were trying to connect awkwardly to the previous movies. I think she may have been tapping into some of the things that worked before with M in that piece. But man, she was so good in this. To be able to be connected to the previous series and yet still keep me in the zone of, oh, this is something different. She nailed that. And having her be that one connecting thread that happens to still be there, it worked.
Agreed.
To not have in the movie a scene where someone comes in and says, let me show you the goods we have for you, for your mission, and this and that, and this.
That would be one of the things I did want to see.
As much as I love Desmond Llewellyn in the movies, he would not have fit in this one.
No, but you didn't have to do it like that. You could still have a quartermaster come in and go, hey, we've been working on some stuff that might help you out.
I don't even want him to have the special gadgets in this movie.
I was just going to say, I think the lack of special gadgets in this particular movie is actually one of its strengths. And I'm with you, Chris. I love the gadgetry. I think that was one of the things that attracted me to Bond as a child, was all the gimmicks that he would always use and all the cool cars and all that. But I think for this movie...
And I would agree.
On year one, essentially, the grittiness that works to its strength.
I think this is also me just going back in hindsight, going like, oh, geez, they really just didn't give him shit at all in these. It's like, you can give him you gave him a gun that's only going to fire with his palm print. But it's like, wait, can you give him something? I mean, can you give him a microphone and a pen? Like, for crying out loud.
We're forgetting something. His resurrection came from a device that they had planted in the car.
Yeah, that's the only
There's portable defibrillators now.
They had those back then.
They also had in his. They also had a locator in his.
Tracking.
They were. Yeah, they went
had
to
that
more
license to kill too. I mean,
They had practical spy gadgets. It was.
Hold on. I mean, the thing is, on the plus side, they made it actually look like an IT guy installing that chip in Bond's arm.
True.
Okay.
I'm not saying I need. Hold on.
Also, he had that device that allowed him to see where Lechiffre was when he put the tracker in his inhaler.
Oh yeah, okay, but there was gadgets, so mundane, they're just a lot, to show you what you're going to break
a lot closer to the real world.
I understand that, and I get that. It's just at the end of the day, it's still a Bond movie. I still want that air, that slight air of unreality, just a touch.
Not in this one.
Well, no, there was Katerina Marino being with that slimy Demetrios guy. There's only one reason she would have been with him is money.
Money outweighs. Yeah. Well, don't you know?
That's realistic.
Yeah, that's incredible.
I have neither.
It's the most realistic thing in the movie.
Yeah.
So I wanted to get back to Jeffrey Wright. I think other than Jack Lord, my favorite Felix Leiter.
Oh yeah, he has more turns at it too.
So.
But even just this one performance, he's
very American.
He has taken over for Bernie Casey as my second favorite Felix Leiter, David Hedison.
I always liked David Hedison.
But certainly
prior to Jeffrey Wright, Jack Lord is the actor of the finest caliber who played Felix. But Jeffrey Wright, in his introduction on the stairwell there, where he's identifying himself to Bond, it's a freaking great intro. And I don't know that I saw it coming. I can't remember that. But
I really
liked it. I thought getting him for multiple films was a very good thing, and which ends up adding more weight to his performance in this movie, whether that's fair or not. And it's just outstanding choice.
Well, what I like, my thought process was Jack Lord was the American James Bond. Mm-hmm. He was the total counterpart to Bond, mm-hmm. but he was the same basic structure.
Yeah.
Jeffrey Wright is probably equally, his Felix Leiter is probably equally capable as Bond, but in very, very different ways.
Yeah.
He's not just a different version of Bond. He's a different character altogether. Yeah. And I like that they did that. Some of the other Felix Leiters in
between.
I mentioned Goldfinger's my favorite movie, my favorite Bond movie. Probably had the worst Felix Leiter ever.
And that would have been great with Jack Lord.
Yes.
Yeah, it wouldn't have been, it would not have been so deferential to Bond. Like, here, we're here to set you up. Here, it's T-ball, you know?
Yeah.
It's funny. There's that scene right after Bond has beaten Lechiffre and everybody else. And Bond walks behind Felix, and they're both looking the same way. And it made me feel almost like Kirk and Spock standing there. You know, like in Star Trek 2009, when they're having their conversation before blowing up Eric Bana's character. Just the way that he stands behind him, you can just say, yeah, these are lifelong buddies. Again, Jeffrey Wright is about my favorite actor on the planet. Ever since I saw him in Shaft, I was like, no, this guy is something amazing, and he's never disappointed me.
A couple other actors I wanted to make mention of. First is Mads Mikkelsen, who I don't remember ever seeing before.
I think
this
is a
movie.
Lot of people's introduction to Mads Mikkelsen.
Yeah.
I just thought he was just slimy and just a great, you know, he wasn't the guy who was going to outfight Bond.
No.
But he also wasn't even the criminal mastermind with everybody below him, because there are people above him in his organization. But just the desperation of his character, the fact that Bond saves him at one point and he still is out to get him. There's just so many things there. I just thought he was a great choice.
Well, he kind of almost feels like he's not quite off the page, but it's like, if you were going to harken back to the 60s stuff, is he as broad as a deformed Connery or Moore villain would have been? No, but he still has a deformity. Yeah. It's mild, but it's there. And I mean,
it's mild. It's a bleeding eye.
Nothing sinister, I assure you. It's like, well, no, of course it's sinister. Like, you are sinister. It's like, that was just the right amount of that. Let's throw a little bit of that 60s flavor in.
Then the ruthless desperation. You mentioned desperation before, but it's that ruthlessness. You had this feeling like he's been in this position before and he's survived because he's willing to go to limits. That, I mean, what he was doing to Bond in that chair.
That's it, right out of the book, too, man. Like, yeah. And they didn't show. I was like, oh my God, they're going there.
Yeah,
they're,
that was so painful to watch.
Yeah.
And then Craig just laughing hysterically because F you, that's why. And it's just like, this is the guy. I mean, come on. Yeah. How is this not the guy at this point?
Yeah.
let's see. I mentioned Jesper Christensen, who played Mr. White. The funny thing is, the note I had for him was he reminded me of an older Tony Randall.
Oh my God! I'm never going to be able to watch this the same way. Not quite as Faye, but okay.
There's a great line in Gremlins 2 where Tony Randall's voicing the talking gremlin.
Yes.
And says, it's sheer pandemonium here. We're telling all our clients to put everything they got into cans, food, and shotguns. And now I'm going to hear that when I look at this guy.
I'm ruining the movie for everybody.
No.
I think he made it better.
I mean, first off, I'm a huge Odd Couple fan, both the movie and the TV show, because there's some great history there. But he also used to, when he was pushing American Eagle snack brand snack foods, he would show up in the audience in Letterman eating the product. So this actually makes me like Mr. White better now. I'm sorry.
Well, I heard in the next one, there's a guy who looks like Jack Klugman.
Mr. White, he's one of those villains. He pops in and out. He's there. He's shady. He's sinister. You don't know what's up, but you get interested. Who is this guy? What's going on? And they still don't. You still don't quite have all the answers at the end, but. I mean, by the end of this movie, like, you're in. It's like, I have to see what happens next because they're clearly doing let's do one that follows another. How well they pull that off.
I did not feel that way. When I saw this in the end, when he shoots him in the leg, and James Bond, I thought he's going to kill him, he's going to take him in, whatever it's going to be, it could be over right there. There's nothing that says it had to continue in the sequel. I did not expect a sequel. Because I'd never had that in a Bond movie before. I never expected a sequel to pick up right where this one left off. And when we talk about Quantum of Solace, we'll discuss that more.
I will save my rants for then. I always hoped for that. Never got it. And certainly didn't expect it at the end of this movie. I saw this as, okay, now he's Bond.
Mm-hmm. Same here.
See, the vibe I got out of this was, after she dies and then he shows up and shoots Mr. White, I felt it was like from On Her Majesty's Secret Service segueing into Diamonds Are Forever, where he's hunting Blofeld.
Or For Your Eyes Only, when he drops him in the chimney. But the last guy I wanted to make mention of was Giancarlo Giannini from Mathis. I liked his portrayal because you never knew. Did he betray Bond? Didn't he betray Bond? Well, you know, what's the deal? When Bond thinks he betrays him and he's there like half conscious and he's like, no, not Mathis. Just great stuff.
Yeah.
Yep.
I liked him. I liked him a lot.
Yeah.
He has kind of the thankless role. I'm your attaché in this different country that you're not from. Like, it's a tough role to pull off and actually be entertaining and charming in.
Yes, very much so.
And I liked how he played it with the body in the trunk and everything else like that.
Yeah. The police chief.
Yeah.
What did everybody think of the theme song?
Probably a top three.
Was that Chris really? Cornell?
Oh, God, yeah.
One of my all-time favorites.
Yep. Top three.
I really enjoyed that.
Well, not here. Oh, my God, we got a rock and roll song in a Bond movie. And it look, a lot of people don't like Soundgarden. I'm not a huge Soundgarden fan. Chris Cornell can blow the roof off any venue that he was in. His voice is spectacular.
I did not seriously dislike this theme song, but it did not have the elements of Bond that I look for. And I would say what I look for is either the bombastic Diamonds Are Forever, Goldfinger by Shirley Bassey, or The Adventure of Live and Let Die by Paul McCartney. It didn't have any of that stuff. I know it kind of fit the tone of the movie.
It's the same. But it's grittier and
it's just not
level.
A song that really goes for me. That's all I could say.
I like
and,
it a lot.
And I'll use that as a stepping stone right into, although I thought the score was okay, I thought it made too much heavy use of that particular song in it, which kind of turned me off a little bit.
They kind of all do, though. I mean,
but some of them work and some of them, like, I loved Live and Let Die, the way they use the theme song in the
score.
That's also
my top three, so.
But in this one, I didn't really like the way they moved it into the score. Maybe it's because I wasn't that crazy about the song.
And I mean, and again, that's, I mean, I think we're all kind of broadly different on the Bond themes that we like. I mean, I don't particularly, you know, cream over most of them because it's not my cup of tea, and I got no problem with that. Like the GoldenEye theme, Tina Turner is a hell of a singer. Is the GoldenEye theme that great? I mean, but it fits the time. I mean, in terms of vocal performances, they've all had pretty damn good vocal performances. But I'm the idiot that really likes The Man with the Golden Gun, even though Alice Cooper got the shaft and they, you know, had the had the pop disco song. You know, so what do I know?
I like Duran Duran doing what A View to a Kill.
That's a great one too,
and that one really nailed it with the whole movie.
View to a Kill,
also a great song.
I'm gonna go way off. Gonna go way off topic here. View to a Kill to me is the best Bond theme with the worst Bond movie.
Yeah, I'd agree with that.
Yeah, I'm not saying it's the worst Bond movie.
I think you said this before.
I'm saying the combination, the one where the theme song is so much better than
that. Yeah.
I thought View to a Kill was the second best rock and roll theme song, because Live and Let Die is the best rock and roll theme song to me.
Absolutely.
So I thought that was the second best of those. But, you know, back to this one. Scott, you're my score guy. What did you think of the score of this movie?
I was hoping you would ask. So
I withdraw the question.
Unfortunately, we're out of time.
Because I had skipped the Pierce Brosnan Bonds, you know, I'd always heard this one in isolation. And in isolation, I thought, you know, this is a really good and powerful score. Again, I was always impressed by the fact that he did the entire movie, and the only time you hear the James Bond theme is at the very conclusion of the film when he says the line, James Bond. And so I was very impressed with that. I remain very impressed with that. But my being impressed with this score goes up a whole nother level when you realize that, you know, now that I've seen the other film, you know, I filled in the gap, essentially. This is his fourth James Bond score in a row. And he's still kicking ass and doing completely original scores. And this one had the challenge of he couldn't just lean on that crutch of, oh, I'll just play the James Bond theme throughout the thing. He had to score the movie. And I really am impressed by the job that he did with that. I think it's a very, very good action movie score. I think it's it feels more, much like the movie itself, it feels more contemporaneous with the movies of its time.
In a better way than GoldenEye does.
Yeah. And I really like the Brosnan film scores that he did. But by the third one, he was kind of getting into a bit of a rut where he was having to get a little bit more experimental with the sound, essentially, to differentiate the scores, because it's like, how much can you really vary up the James Bond scores before they just start to kind of sound repetitive? with this one, again, he didn't have that crutch. He couldn't lean on that score. He had to come up with something that felt like it fit without using the character's themes. And that's hard to do. I mean, imagine John Williams scoring a Indiana Jones film and he can't use dun 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 dun. How the hell do you score that?
But I think that's a bigger issue with modern composing of the last 20 years, is that nobody goes for leitmotif. They all go for ambient sound, you know, and it drives me up the wall. Everybody loves Hans Zimmer. It's like, I don't get it, man. Like,
no, I don't either.
I'm sure technically it's all fantastic, but like, you need to be able to write themes. And it's like, and that's tough. Like, imagine because the original Bond movies, they had the two themes. They had the walking theme, the kind of jaunty, not the main theme. They had the main theme and the kind of lilting walking style theme. Those would get played in every single one for decades.
Bond Back in Action. I know just the one you're talking about.
I'm terrible with titles for orchestral stuff. So it's like, at this point, if you're going to restart and redo, now you can write new themes so that you have more stuff to play with and harken back to. Like, you know, did Vesper get her own theme in this? I can't quite remember. Yeah, so like anytime going forward, and I don't think they really did, but like anytime you want to hammer that sentimental point home, play the Vesper theme. Like, there's, you know, there's reasons to write new stuff, and a lot of people don't do it, or they just take the easy way out of, I'm just going to do the wall of sound and I don't really care.
Oh my God, I'm so happy to have another soundtrack geek on this. You're speaking my language.
I know it's a generational thing, but I think a lot of guys don't know how to do it. But then you look at a guy like Howard Shore, who scores David Cronenberg stuff, and then he scores Lord of the Rings. And those things could not be more opposite. Like, but if you're that good of a composer, you can make something for whatever you're being given. And I think a lot of people don't do that, or they hire the guy that they know, this is what he's going to bring, and I know what I'm going to get, which is going to be wow, and that's all it is.
Right.
And if that's what you're going for, that's fine, but there's no reason for me to, like, I mean, the Lord of the Rings scores are probably the last ones where I'd be like, I need to have physical copies of these, and those movies came out over 20 years ago. It really is a generational thing, I think.
But I agree with
me off my soapbox.
I agree with much of what you said,
and that's why I love you, Scott.
David Arnold to me is a wonderful bridge between those two types of styles, because his stuff isn't just background music. Like, I loved what you said about Hans Zimmer, because that guy to me is, that's the composer that you go to when your franchise is about to die. Because if you notice his last several works, he was the last composer for now dead franchises. You've got X-Men, you've got, you know, several different ones where, you know, they had all these great scores, and then the last thing they do, they get Hans Zimmer and the franchise dead.
So. Well, the first Pirates score is good. But again, that was a new IP, and it was like, oh, I get to go, I'm going to make everything for this. Oh, let me make a waltz that's up-tempo, and that's going to be your main theme. Like, that's a good score. Like, that's a hummable score. And I'm not saying the score has to be hummable, but Jesus, it's got to fit the action. And like, when you turn the movie off, you go, eh, da, 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 and you're thinking about some of the stuff you heard.
Right.
Modern stuff. I mean, maybe Alan Silvestri's stuff for Avengers. That's probably the most recent stuff.
There's still out there. I can, you know, this is a whole different conversation, but I can give you some modern composers that...
Yeah, private message me some stuff that I should listen to, for sure.
If you like that John Williams school of thought of...
Jerry Goldsmith, Alan Silvestri, John Williams, like, those are the guys.
There are some modern guys doing that.
Michael Giacchino. You know?
And Giacchino, yes.
Yeah, that's the first one that came to my mind. Yeah, Giacchino, Brian Tyler... Tyler Bates to a certain degree. Yeah, there are some good ones out there.
And also Jackman.
I still like Eric Serra.
Jackman, yeah.
I don't hate his score for GoldenEye. It's very much of the time. And I think on that show I said, like, I like it. Like, I think it fits the movie, but it is very much of a time. It's one of those things that when you listen to it, you ping that right at, what, 1993? Whenever that came out. That is set right there.
I think there are some. I think there are some guys working in TV that are really good and they do less work per episode than a movie, but over long form television, like streaming series and things like that, I think Jeff Beal is amazing.
That's a name I'm not familiar with.
Christopher Lenert, he came to my attention. He did the score for a video game called Gun, and I've kind of kept an ear out for him ever since. And he did recently did the Lost in Space series.
There was one guy. There was a guy who started in TV that I always heard was good. This guy, John Williams.
I thought he was a jazz player.
He was Johnny Williams back then.
Johnny Williams.
When he played the piano on Peter Gunn.
Mm.
Yep.
And when he wrote Lost in Space, and of course Lost in Space for me, the season 3 theme is the one that does it, but
yeah.
Like Beale, I love the acoustic guitar theme for the first season of Monk. It's my friend Grant Geisman who played it. Grant is a big EC Comics and Mad Magazine expert who happens to be a Grammy nominated jazz musician.
Right. All of that said,
I think it's time
to come back to Casino Royale.
Okay.
What David Arnold achieved in this was, I think, Scott, your point is that it's pretty amazing considering that he had done the three previous and yeoman's work, in my opinion, on those, but that he absolutely shifted palettes on this one.
Yep.
And
That's pretty impressive, even if you don't like it, and I happen to like it a lot.
Yeah, it's very good.
All right. So, you know what? Maybe I'm wrong.
Maybe you are.
We love you anyway.
I don't think I'm wrong, but maybe I am. Anyway, what I'm pretty confident that I'm not wrong about is my favorite Bond movie is Goldfinger. Again, I think up from Dr. No to this, I think this is the best film. And I think as we go on, there may be some debate on if one exceeds it, but we'll see. I think this, I just have no question in my mind. This is totally rewatchable. Mm-hmm. The performances are layered. The directing is as good as this particular director got on any movie. The cinematography is phenomenal. This is a Jaws movie. And I think as we went through it, I'm not sure we hit on any true negative in it. So as far as I'm concerned, this is Jaws. Now, the order of the people on my screen has changed over the time since we started, but I'm going to still bring us around clockwise. So, Brian, you are next.
Yeah, no, I agree with you in most every case. It's a fantastic film. Again, one I've watched so many times. And it's the first James Bond film where they actually had a ringing scene. I thought that was actually rather interesting. I was racking my brain to see if there was another raining scene in any other Bond film, and I couldn't find one. That being said, yeah, this one's Jaws to me. It is an all-time classic. I think I've watched it more times than a lot of other movies. I would say I've watched this more than Return of the Jedi.
That's old talk. Scott, you're next.
Ooh, I was hoping there were a few more people in there got to me, because I certainly don't want to be the dissenting opinion on where.
You're welcome to be the dissenting opinion if that is your opinion.
I can't decide whether it is truly a Jaws or just a very high Jaws 2 for me, because I certainly think it is a great movie. It is very possibly the best James Bond, just as far as the way it's put together, the cinematography, all that sort of thing. Maybe not the best score, although I do think a lot of the score. I don't really have any negatives about the movie per se, you know, as far as like strong criticisms or anything. There's just things that leave me a little confused and a little muddled about the movie, because I'm still not entirely clear on what everybody's motivation was and what the whole point of the plot of the movie was. Although, again, I enjoy watching it. And I still think, while I love Vesper and Bond getting together, I love them as a couple. I'm so sad when she dies every time I see the movie, and I'm gutted in later movies when he's still mourning her. That said, I think that she too quickly for me goes from keeping him at arm's length to suddenly telling him outright, I'm yours. Do with me what you will. And I'm always struggling every time I rewatch the movie to find the point, like, what changed? Why did her attitude suddenly flip-flop?
Shared trauma.
Yeah, I guess that must be it. But beyond that, I mean, I do absolutely love this movie. It's entirely rewatchable. The only box it doesn't tick on my personal criteria for Jaws is quotability, because I can't really think of a line in this that I quote on a regular basis, and nothing's really coming to mind. So, but that seems such a minor thing. It's like, I don't really want that to be the thing that holds it back from being Jaws. So
Scott, I use the bitch is dead all the time.
And I know one particular line that you actually quote almost every other day.
Uh-oh.
Do I look like I give a damn?
That's my personal feeling on everything now at 45.
That is very true. It's tough for me. I think I'm going to settle at a very, very high Jaws 2. I'm
Philistine!
Not sure Jaws for me.
Okay, Jeff, you're next.
Jaws. After the last few films, I'm sure that somebody booted out whether I liked movies.
A little bar to clear.
I just, honest to goodness, love this movie. I can watch it over and over. I like so many things. I manage to see different things in it at different times. I always enjoy that with any kind of movie. And I just really like what they tried, what I think they attempted and what they achieved. And I can't hold what comes later against this movie. I still think this is not only a great movie, well made, it is a noble effort.
All right, Chris.
I don't know if I can give it a Jaws either. It would be a very high Jaws too. I don't think any Bond will ever be a Jaws. And again, that's just because the nature of what the franchise is. You're not often going to get a ton of thematic weight, let's be honest. If the relaunch dives into that, then I don't know if it would even be Bond. At that point,
like Goldthwait.
There you go. That'd be a very different Bond. I'd pay money for that. Make him Felix Leiter. It'd be interesting. Okay, my terrible Bobcat impression done. A very high Jaws too. This one, I will say this. This is the only one of the Craig movies that I have watched more than twice. And there's one that I still haven't seen because it was spoiled for me and I proactively hate it. So we'll have a fun in a couple of months when we get to that one. As a relaunch, it's fantastic. As a film, it's fantastic. If you were somebody that's on the fence about watching a Bond movie, this is probably the one that I would have them watch. And then I would say the quality is going to vary whether you go forward or go backward. If you really liked this one, these are the two or three that I would suggest you watch next. If you liked those as well, then here's the next couple that you should watch. And then here's a couple that you should just steer clear from. But again, super entertaining. Anytime I throw it on, I get sucked in. I sit down for the 2.5 hours and just eat it up with a spoon.
Okay, Dave.
I resisted seeing this movie for many, many years. And a lot of it was, you know, the internet stuff. I was a fan of the books. I read them too in, you know, early high school, I guess. And I remember Casino Royale. Other than, you know, the horror of the ending, it being kind of maybe, I think it was a bit boring. to me at the time. Because, I mean, it's a book about a card game, basically. So I held off. I had my thoughts about Daniel Craig. That, you know, to me, James Bond has jet black hair, just like Ian Fleming wrote it. I didn't want to participate. And the somewhat of an origin that it was going to be turned me off. I couldn't have been more wrong about this. It sucked me in from the beginning. I felt there were a lot of, I don't even know if they were intentional or I just wanted to see it, Easter eggs to previous films. The obvious one is the 64 DB5. But I felt even kind of, maybe the opening scene in black and white was almost like a tribute to that original Casino Royale with Jimmy Bond, the American. The blue shorts he was wearing reminded me of Thunderball. There was just a vibe. I know they were in the Bahamas, right? Not Jamaica, but I got a real Dr. No vibe out of that. And I really found it enjoyable. And having only watched it once, I'm going to venture to say that this could potentially be a Jaws. And that's right. Where I'm going to leave it for now, and future viewings will let us know.
Okay, last but not least, Mr. Whalen.
I'll tell you why it's a Jaws for me. It works on a couple different levels. The first level is, back in the time when this came out, everything that was working against this film should not have made it. And today, I would actually make an argument it probably wouldn't, because of just the buzz around this film, and it would just not have made it today. And I hate to say that, but it's kind of the truth. What's so great about this film is that you watch it, and once you start watching this film, whether we all agree it's Jaws or not, it's irrelevant. If you actually watch this movie, it pulls you in and does not let go until the very end. And that's something I think we all can agree on here with this film, wherever you fall on this piece. And every time I watch it, it does something where this is the other level it works on for me. The day after I finished watching this for the purpose of this podcast, I'm playing in my car my Bond playlist. Not just the music from this film, all of my favorite Bond themes. I want to hear all of them. We all have different ones. Our mixes are going to be different. But Bond is one of those film series where there's so much of the music, both the themes and the music playing throughout the film, that there's so many favorite tracks that I have, and I just love them on shuffle. There's certain films that just make me want more. This one makes me want to watch it again. It makes me want to watch other Bond movies. I don't care about going in chronological order, although I feel like I'm ready for starting a Dr. No and working my way through again. And that's something that this film generates. This is one I would show people and say, you never seen James Bond before? There's a handful of them that are the ones that, like, this is a good one to watch to see if it's right for you.
Yep.
And this is one where I would say they're not all equal, as any franchise you can say that with, but this is one I would say, watch this. If you don't like this, you're probably not going to like the other ones either. No. But if you do, you're probably going to love this franchise, and you're going to want to watch more of them. And I'll give you a list of where you should go from here, because it wouldn't be in order. But this is a film that I would say is a must watch out of the James Bond series.
Yeah,
I agree with you that it's a must watch, but I'm going to disagree to an extent that if somebody says, "Oh, I'm not familiar with the James Bond franchise," I don't know that I would say, "Oh, watch this. And if you don't like this, you're not going to like Bond," because the tone of this is so very, very different from everything that came before it, that you could argue that this is a different style of movie. And somebody might prefer the lighthearted Roger Moore movies or the intense but less intense Timothy Dalton movies, you know, or the lighthearted Pierce Brosnan moments, you know, or Sean Connery, whatever. I think they all have their own feel. So I don't know that they are mutually exclusive, that if you don't like this one, you won't like them. In fact, I think there's a lot of people who might say, oh, I love James Bond for the adventure and the lightheartedness. This one was too intense for me. So in that regard, I do think they are different, and I think this is a great movie. Don't get, you know? Yeah, I think I made that clear, but I don't think it is necessarily part of the same. Even though it's part of the same franchise, it's not.
No,
sure. Listen, anything that's been around this long is going to have different flavors. I wanted to say two things. First off, I think I've said this before, but I want to make sure. I love doing this with you guys because there's so many different, very well-informed opinions on this that it's really a joy to have this conversation, because I know that we're going to have different viewpoints on something, and some of which you may convince me, and some of which you won't. Like, this is the best movie, and anybody doesn't think so, it's just wrong. I so love this movie. This is the other personal anecdote I want to share. I so love the opening of this movie that the first five pages of my comic book Captain Action versus Al Capone Vampire are black and white to set up the whole story.
Oh, that's why you did this.
It was exactly why I did that, because I knew in my head I was setting the tone for the story.
Awesome.
Nice.
So this panel, and I would just mention Chris Eberle, who had been with Sean and me to talk about the Daredevil movies, was going to join us today, and then we had some technical problems. He wasn't able to. So I expect the next time we do a James Bond movie, it will be Quantum of Solace, and it will be this group plus Chris. So I look forward to that, and I hope everybody who's listening does as well. I thank you all for coming on. I enjoy it every bit as much as Jeff does. And I look forward to coming back, and I hope you look forward to listening to us. Thank you all. Bye-bye.
Mathis says the Americans have made contact with Le Chiffre. They're going to extract him before dawn.
You know, I think I'll call that a Vespa.
Because of the bitter aftertaste?
No. Because once you've tasted it, that's all you want to drink. Oh, that was quite a good line.
It was a very good line.
But you're laughing at it.
Not so much it as you.
Oh, well, that's fine. I figured out what that is. It's an Algerian love knot.
Really? I thought it was just something pretty.
No, you didn't. Someone gave that to you. He's a very lucky man.
You can switch off so easily, can't you? It doesn't bother you, killing those people.
Well, I wouldn't be very good at my job if it did.
I don't believe you. You've got a choice, you know. Just because you've done something doesn't mean you have to keep doing it.
Why is it people who can't take advice always insist on giving it?
You think I can't take my own advice?
I think something is driving you. And I think I'll never find out what that is.
Mathis needs me. Good night. Congratulations again.